Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. As you've been hearing in our weekly series on how teachers and school districts are dealing with learning and the care for children, as well as the safety of staffs during this pandemic, schools across the Commonwealth are facing entirely new costs and challenges, not only from COVID-19, but also the historic recession that came with it. Funding within many districts is a challenge during the best of times, but some districts are better positioned to weather this crisis than others. With us to look at how that's playing out in school districts across the Commonwealth is Anna Bauman, Deputy Director of the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy in Berea. Hi, Anna.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm very good, and thanks for joining us. And
thank you.
I know that your organization recently published an analysis of the relative fiscal well-being of Kentucky's 171 school districts. And it's that analysis that we want to focus on here. First, if you could give us a broad picture of what that research reveals.
Well, I thought I would start a little bit with the history of the situation.
Sure.
So in 1989, the Kentucky Supreme Court decided in the Rose decision that we as a state were failing our constitutional mandate to provide kids across Kentucky with an efficient education. And so a big piece of that was that we weren't providing kids across the state with an equitable education. Where you lived really impacted the resources that were going into your education. So the following year, in 1990, the legislature passed the Kentucky Education Reform Act. And a big piece of that was to reform our funding. So folks have heard about SEEK. The SEEK formula is an equalizing formula that takes that problem of unequal resources, depending on which district the student is going to school in, and provide state funding to equalize those resources across districts. So, you know, in the late 80s, when the Kentucky Supreme Court made that decision, the gap in funding between poor and wealthy districts was really wide. And then after KERA and after all those state resources started going to equalize district funding, that gap shrank by a lot. And let me back up a little bit and say, one of the things that KERA did was to raise a lot of state revenue. We closed especially some income tax expenditures that allowed the state to raise a lot of money to put into the SEEK formula. So that gap went down, but then in the 2000s, it really started ticking back up again. And that trend has continued. And what our analysis shows is that with the most recent data we have available to us, we're actually spending nearly $3,000 less per student in the poorest districts compared to the wealthiest districts in Kentucky. We're just $208 shy of where we were before the Kentucky Education Reform Act. And to tell you just how rapidly that problem is growing, the gap grew by $122 in the most recent year we have the data for. So the level of inequity is bad and it's growing quickly. And we're concerned that we're fighting the twin crises right now of a pandemic, but also inequitable school funding that is close to what we as a state once decided was unconstitutional.
So we had that burst of improvement and it was sustained for quite a while following the Supreme Court decision, SEEK, KERA. What factors drive the gap that has been forming between wealthy and poor districts?
You can kind of understand it yourself if you've driven across Kentucky. You drive across Kentucky and you see that different communities, different school districts have different resources. You've got wealthier communities like Anchorage versus poorer communities like Floyd. Those are two school districts. Anchorage is in the wealthiest group of school districts that the analysis references, and Floyd is in the poorest. And so because we have a property tax-based local funding system where school districts raise money for their schools based primarily on their property tax base, what happens is that different districts can raise different amounts of money. So KIRA did fix this and is supposed to fix this through the SEEK formula, where the state raises resources to equalize what those local districts are able to do. But, you know, if you don't put enough money into the SEEK formula, specifically if we don't put enough state resources into the SEEK formula to equalize what we have in each district, then the gap grows wider. So what that points to is that we've had inadequate state funding for our education system, for that equalizing formula. I mean, and we know that because of growing inequity. We also know it just by looking at the cuts that we've made to SEEK over the years and how that's impacted all districts. I should say that our local districts are allowed to, they can levy different kinds of taxes. They can levy utility taxes, occupational taxes, and a few others. But the majority come from property taxes. Again, we have a property tax-based system. In fact, 72% of school district revenue comes from property taxes. So you can see that, you know, the differences in local property wealth really impact what districts are able to do for their students. And, you know, the state's responsibility is to make sure we equalize that with adequate funding. And that's the problem. We haven't been adequately funding our SEEK formula.
And so we have those conditions, the re-emerging gap that you've been talking about. And along comes this heavyweight recession that we're dealing with now. And we really don't know how it's going to go, when it's going to end. And your analysis forecasts, quoting here, potentially devastating impacts for students in poorer communities. What does that mean? What sorts of impacts can be anticipated?
Well, so for this update to our analysis of the equity gap, we talked to some superintendents, and they have big concerns about what this could mean. And let me just back up and say, you know, we're not only potentially facing state-level budget cuts because of revenue shortfalls related to COVID, but also, of course, local revenue shortfalls. And, you know, we need Congress to step in and stabilize those state and local budgets so that we can continue to fund education. But if we don't see that happen, then there can be some pretty devastating impacts, as you said. So when we talk to superintendents in some of the poorer districts who are at the bottom of this equity gap, things that they told us that they're concerned about that could happen if we see these big state and local revenue shortfalls are things like they may have to get rid of all-day kindergarten and go back to half-day kindergarten. They could be faced with eliminating universal preschool for all four-year-olds. They could experience reductions to their teaching and support staff that would increase class sizes and reduce the student-teacher relationships. They could experience teacher loss because of continued salary freezes. They're facing fewer courses, electives, dual credit opportunities and remediation opportunities, less after-school summer school tutoring, getting behind on virtual learning, not being able to connect with students through the internet or because they don't have the right devices, loss of on-site dental and health clinics, fewer mental health counselors and therapists, not being able to fulfill school security and safety expectations, less professional learning opportunities for teachers. I mean, even less capacity to provide school meals. The list is just really concerning. And you know, while reading off, and I'm sure for the audience listening to a list like that, there's a pit of fear and sadness for the students and for their families and for the communities. In the short term, we also have to be really concerned about the long-term impacts of setting our students so far back.
I noticed in reading your material, something that leapt off the page for me was that the federal aid that's been provided to states in the COVID-19 pandemic so far is sufficient to close only one-fifth of state revenue gaps. So what do you think? How will any additional education budget cuts caused by the pandemic magnify these existing problems and disparities?
Yeah, well, you know, half measures simply aren't going to cut it. If Congress doesn't come in with flexible, general, robust aid for state and local governments to stabilize their budgets, it will force education cuts. So that long list of things I just mentioned, you know, that could be an eventual reality for many Kentucky school districts. A huge share, more than half of our state general fund spending goes to education. So you can just imagine that in the situation where the funding relief that's been provided so far to the state, it's been important, but it hasn't been enough. You mentioned that one-fifth estimate of the one-fifth, it's covered one-fifth of state revenue gaps. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's been important, but it's far from what we need. It's far from adequate to stabilize our state budget. And with so much of our state resources going to education, you can just understand that general revenue shortfalls are going to necessitate education budget cuts. And we know that education budget cuts hurt all districts and that they hurt the lower wealth districts the most. And I want to jump back to a point, which is that those cuts hurt all districts. We've had a decade of state budget cuts to education since the Great Recession. And we did a survey of districts a few years ago that showed that of all districts, wealthy and poor alike, 54% had fewer instructional days in the school calendar than they had before the Great Recession. More than a third had reduced or eliminated art and music programs. More than a third had fewer special course offerings. I mean, we have a long list on that one, too. So these state-level cuts impact all school districts. They're just especially hard on those poorer districts. And so, again, if Congress doesn't come in and do its job, and again, only Congress can do this job, and that's because, you know, the state faces a balance budget requirement. We can only spend what we bring in, and since COVID will impact what we bring in, if Congress doesn't provide that aid to cover the shortfall, we'll have to make cuts. Actually, the Office of the State Budget Director came out, it was either last week or the week before, with its quarterly economic analysis, and it forecasts a pretty steep revenue shortfall in the coming year. It gave a couple estimates, and even assuming that we will face pretty major revenue shortfalls that will require us to make cuts, it baked into those assumptions that Congress would continue to provide a number of different kinds of aid that they provided earlier on in the pandemic. A lot of that aid is already dried up, and we don't know if they're going to do their job to provide more. So that bleak revenue forecast could get a lot worse if we don't see Congress step in with a kind of robust aid package that we need to keep our general fund full enough to keep education and health and other services going.
And yet we're reading lately that it's not likely we're going to see another stimulus package anytime soon. Have you seen that as well?
Yes, that's definitely the word on the street, and it's important to note in some of our districts in the coal fields, there's an added crisis of the loss of an industry that, you know, has historically provided income and security to families in those communities.
And so, tax base.
That's right, and the tax base. That's exactly right. So the crisis brewing for all districts, but especially poor districts, and then even more so for districts in the coal fields, is just very concerning. And in short term, Congress is the only body that can address that.
Is your most recent analysis available online?
It is, yes. Go to our website at www.kypolicy.org, and we've got an issue areas drop-down menu, and you can go to education and learn all about this issue and many others that we track when it comes to the education that we as a state are providing to our students.
Anna Bauman is Deputy Director of the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy in Berea. Thanks, Anna.
Thanks so much, Tom. It's great to be with you. We'll be right back.
Turning now to the latest school district in our series on how teachers, school administrators, students, and staffs are managing the task of educating our children under the uncertain conditions imposed on us all by this pandemic. This week's focus, Madison County Schools, opening to in-person classes for those who choose to return to classroom instruction on Monday, September 28th. Here's series co-host, Tanya May.
Joining us today is the superintendent of Madison County Schools, Dr. David Gillum. Superintendent Gillum, thank you for joining us today and being a part of our Reopening Kentucky Schools series.
Well, thank you, Tanya. It's good to be with you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Would you begin by providing some general information for our audience that will help to familiarize them with the Madison County school system?
Sure, absolutely. Madison County Schools, we're the ninth largest school district in the state. We have 19 schools, 12,000 students, about 2,000 employees, 850 or so are certified staff, and then the remainder there would be classified staff and or part-time workers.
So before we begin to discuss your fall reopening plan, can you talk about some of the biggest challenges you faced as a district when schools closed suddenly last March?
Well, the biggest, the biggest challenge was just the uncertainty. When schools closed in March, we did not know initially how long that was going to be. We were told to prepare to close down for a couple of weeks, maybe three, and we were thinking that primarily we would be back following spring break, and the closure just continued to grow and to lengthen as the remainder of the year went on. And so not knowing when on March, essentially the 16th is whenever we entered into that venture, not knowing then how long it would be, we were kind of putting in instructionally just some temporary, some temporary plans and some temporary stop gaps and providing essentially a temporary instructional plan there for the first several weeks. And had we known that at that point that was going to be it for the year, I think we would have approached it a little differently. But that was the biggest piece.
Yes, of course. So in moving to thinking about your current fall reopening plan, can you describe the plan for us and give us your potential reopening date?
Sure. Our plan, we knew that a one-size-fits-all wouldn't work for our community, so we put different options out there for parents, as did a lot of districts. We have an in-person traditional school model, and then we have a couple of different models on the distance learning side. One is we're referring to that as My School Online or our interactive distance learning piece, and then the other would be an independent distance learning piece. So those two models, of course, I think everybody knows what the traditional in-person would be, but mm-hmm. the other two, the difference between those two is the interactive My School Online. The student has a fixed schedule. They're able to log on at specific times throughout the day and be face-to-face with a teacher and peers and working through. So it's more face-to-face instruction, whereas the other piece, we're working through some programs such as Edgenuity or iReady or the Ready curriculum and or using some interactive pieces that teachers have placed on Google Classroom sites. And students would work through that at essentially their own pace and then receive follow-up from teachers along the way. But they would have points at which they would submit work and just kind of keep up with it as opposed to a specific time every day face-to-face.
Okay. So, as parents and families were given the option, do you know what percentage of your families at this point have chosen face-to-face instruction?
Yes, right at 70% chose that, and that's what we anticipated from day one. All of our data going into this, whether that's just some of the national trend data or some of the different surveys that have been given by different districts along the way, and as well our specific survey that we sent out to parents and stakeholders at the 1st of June, just to get that initial feeling, it was right at 70%. And then when we sent out on July the 6th, we actually posted our questionnaire where students would and families would actually go in and select their model. That confirmed the 70% that we've been working with the entire time. Yeah.
Of that remaining 30%, you talked about a synchronous model and an asynchronous model.
Yeah.
Of the remaining 30%, does there seem to be one option that's getting more interest?
Not really. It's almost split down the middle between the two. The difference there is just depends on if a student is not going to be in person, what's their availability and what's their time looking like during that day. And if it may be if it's a younger child, they may go to a grandparent's house or to other type of child care setting. And others might be staying, if they're staying at home, remaining at home with older siblings or remaining at home with their parents. Those folks are tending to select more of the synchronous interactive model, whereas the others are selecting the asynchronous or the more of an independent pacing piece.
Well, for families that feel more comfortable continuing with the remote teaching and learning, I'm sure there probably maybe are still some students who in that group that lack access to internet or technological tools they may need. So is the district providing accommodations for those students and families?
We're trying to do everything we can. There's restrictions and limits. The majority of our numbers in Madison County are pretty solid with the number of folks that have internet service and also have devices available at home. In fact, our numbers in our high schools are very high. One of the downsides to that is oftentimes the type of internet connectivity and or device that students are using is a phone with phone data. But outside of that, we have pretty good numbers across Madison County. We're trying to fill the gaps in there. We do have Chromebooks that are available for loan for students that are on that model that would like to borrow those. They can do that from their school. That's not a problem. The biggest hurdle for us to get over is that availability of internet access. And we're trying to work through. We have our Family Resource Youth Service Centers working on that. So students who do not have that connectivity at home, they can contact the schools and work through those Family Resource Youth Service Centers to try to connect them with some internet providers. And there are some that have there are some programs out there that are available to folks, if they are income eligible, to be able to receive that. But unfortunately, we run into some issues with some people that are just above those income thresholds, but still do not have that. And we're trying to match those up with potentially some hot spots that we're getting out to families that are in some of those circumstances. But that runs into some issues with our filtering systems and those types of things. But we're trying to work through that. So
right. Mm-hmm. Now, in considering the face-to-face instruction, what type of personal protection of equipment and health procedures will be in place as part of this? I mean, will students and staff be expected to do temperature and basic self-health checks before they come to school each morning, or will that be conducted daily on site in the various buildings? How will that unfold?
Okay, it's going to be both. We're asking all of our families to do the health checks before their children ever leave home. But then everyone that goes into our buildings, employees included, will be screened for temperature and or other symptoms, but we're doing a temperature check on everyone. So that's our first layer of screening. And then the other protocols that are in place, the social distancing. And we've done a lot of things logistically within our schools. Every school's kind of unique in the layout and the size and the number of students and number of entries in the hallways and all of that, those different pieces. So every school's come up with a plan to try to make the operations of the day such that distancing is possible. So we've lowered class sizes, spread our students out into more classrooms, and we've been able to do that first of all because we only have 70% of our students coming back, so that automatically lowers those numbers. And then we've added a few different classes or a few different sections so that we spread those students out into smaller groups. We're converting our hallways into one-way hallways as much as possible, so students don't have to pass in the hallways. We've staggered class exchange time. In some cases, our students are staying in the room and teachers are rotating. So every school kind of has a plan to minimize student-to-student contact and maximize the social distancing. As well, masks are required for students students and staff anytime that they are unable to maintain that social distancing 6 feet to 6 foot space, and anytime they're moving throughout the building, and also while they're on a bus. So students would board a bus and they've got the mask on. When they get to school, they wear that mask in. Once they're in their classroom seated and that seat is distanced from other students, then they can pull that mask off. If they need to get up, sharpen a pencil, they need to put that on and get up and do that. If a teacher's bringing a couple of kids together or circulating the room, the teacher would have the mask on as they circulate among the students. So those are a couple of precautions we're using. We're stationing hand sanitizer throughout the buildings in all of the classrooms, on our school buses. So those are just a couple of general things. Then as you get into some of the more specific areas, for example, our school nurses and our therapy workers that work a little closer with students and our receptionists out front, we have some additional distancing pieces such as plexiglass barriers and screens and different types of masks and other PPE that are available to those folks.
Well, finally, as a closing question, do you think there have been very important lessons learned surrounding leadership just at the school level and at the district level that you think will make your district stronger going forward from this situation?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, these are certainly challenging times and certainly not a situation anyone wants to be in. But I think we have learned quite a bit through this, particularly instructionally. You know, our teachers are just doing an awesome job of trying to redesign their instruction, look at how they can utilize the online tools and some different things to be able to reach students. So the next little bit, you know, it's going to be disruptive and we're going to get through it. But once we get through this, I think instruction in our classrooms, because of the ability to really use technology to enhance that instruction is going to be stronger. So that's one piece as well. You know, people have had to step up to the plate. This is uncharted waters, and it certainly is. People have had to learn flexibility. And also, you know, one thing that we had some conversation around just the last couple of days is, you know, during times like these, it's challenging because people want certainty. You know, we want to know what's going to happen. And the one thing we know with this virus is we don't know what's going to happen with it. So that certainty is so important. But, you know, right now we're in a time where we simply can't have that certainty. We don't know. You know, we don't know what the numbers are going to look like in a month from now. We don't know when an outbreak might occur. We don't know when we're going to have a virus. We don't know when we're going to be able to return to all of these things. But in times of uncertainty, while we can't have certainty, what we can have is clarity. And so that's why, you know, making sure that we communicate effectively, making sure that we have our plans in place and everyone is able to see the processes and the pieces as we go through, it makes it very important. And we've learned a lot through that. Hopefully we'll come out better.
Yes. So we certainly appreciate you taking the time to join us today. Obviously, reopening Kentucky schools has been a subject that's been on the forefront of everyone's mind across the state.
True.
So we thank you for your time, and it sounds like you guys have a very solid, well-thought-out plan. So we wish your district much success in the upcoming year.
Thank you. I appreciate it very much.
Coming up after the break, the debut of a new series on Eastern Standard, Conversations About Race in Kentucky and America. The series is hosted by UK historian Gerald Smith, co-chair of Lexington's Commission for Racial Justice and Equality, and his first guest is Dr. William Turner, scholar and consultant on matters of race and diversity, born and reared in the coal town of Lynch, Kentucky.
In the pool rooms and in the dance halls and everywhere, the undercurrent was always about we must make America what America says it is. And so that was part of my upbringing.
And Lexington Councilmember Jennifer Masati on the new statue honoring Kentucky women who fought for their right to vote.
I just felt that we deserve the respect that men already got portrayed across the country.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hickson Funson, Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.org or on the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
We're pleased to bring you another among our growing library of interview series here on Eastern Standard. You can find them all under the series tab at eswEKU.org. Joining us now is University of Kentucky Professor Gerald Smith. Dr. Smith's focuses are in the areas of African American history, race and sports, Black freedom struggle, African American education, and Kentucky African American history. He is co-chair of Lexington's Commission for Racial Justice and Equality, and Dr. Smith is co-editor of the award-winning Kentucky African American Encyclopedia.
It is my pleasure to welcome Dr. William H. Turner, a leading authority on blacks in Appalachia. Dr. Turner has served on the faculty and administrations of several universities, and he is a widely sought-after consultant on issues of race and diversity, and has published extensively in national newspapers, academic journals, and books on the black experience in Appalachia. He is currently the Distinguished Visiting Scholar in Residence at Kentucky State University. Dr. Turner, you are the fifth of 10 children born in 1946 in the coal town of Lynch, Kentucky in Harlan County. How did growing up in Lynch prepare you to be a civil rights activist, a scholar, administrator, and public servant?
Thank you, Dr. Smith, for inviting me on. In terms of a specific question, Lynch, Kentucky, Harlan County was a place and is a place, relatively speaking, where in the era of my own upbringing, being born there 75 years ago almost, I had some of the best teachers in the world, most of whom, 95% of whom, studied at Kentucky State University. And back then, when it started, it was called the Kentucky Normal Institute for Colored Persons. And I think that they came with a calling to bring to the attention of their students the importance of the kind of difference between the American ideal of equality and justice and liberty and the harsh realities under which we live. So we were literally taught every day when we were walking to that school without anybody saying a word. The hallways, the main hallway had photographs of the most iconic figures in African-American life and culture: Paul Laurence Dunbar, Ralph Bunche, Jackie Robinson, Thurgood Marshall, you name it, Ida B. Wells, W.E.B. Du Bois, Booker T. Washington, Carter G. Woodson, and they were in the hallways. And so it was like a subversive education, if you will. So it was like being nourished by the best who taught us that we had this responsibility. And, you know, some of us, of course, attached to it more than others may have. But it was part of my upbringing. But even before that, in my own home, we were raised by grandparents and parents who themselves, though you could put my grandmothers and my father and my mother went to the 10th grade before she got married to my daddy in 1938 at 15 years old. And these folk are like your own folk, your own grandparents in central Kentucky. They had this sense of destiny about what we were doing, what they were doing. And so it all seemed kind of natural to me to be dedicated to this kind of human rights issues. And so that was just part of growing up. We knew what we were up against. We took Jet magazine and we took Ebony magazine, and in the pool rooms and in the dance halls and everywhere, the undercurrent was always about we must make America what America says it is. And so that was part of my upbringing.
You just mentioned Ebony and Jet magazine, and I do know that you wrote an article titled "The Sale of Ebony and Jet Photos Like Eating the Seed Corn." What did you mean by that?
You know, in farm life, we always know that there are these heritage seeds that you keep. Once you grow a crop, you keep some of the seeds so that you can replant them. And in that metaphor, I was trying to say in that article that when Jet and Ebony were sold, that was symbolic of a sea change, as it were, so that the material ownership and control of images and articles and ideas and thoughts and principles are no longer in the control of Black people. And while I am the first one to think that America is a great idea, you know, at one time someone asked that of Mahatma Gandhi, and they said, "What do you think of American civilization?" And he said, "I think that would be a great idea." So the point is, we lost a lot, and we've seen the loss of these cultural mileposts. And in the interest of assimilation and integration, I will leave this earth thinking that we gave up a lot more than we gained.
Now, just a couple of months ago, you also published an essay titled, "Black Lives Have Always Mattered in Appalachia. Just Look to Our History." What actually motivated you to write this essay at this particular time in our history?
I wrote that right after George Floyd was murdered in Minnesota. And I watched several demonstrations that came out of places like Corbin, Kentucky, which was a quintessential sundown town in eastern Kentucky. Even though there are people now doing something called the Sun Up Initiative, one of whom is a University of Kentucky professor. But I could not help but be stricken by the demonstrations that took place in the Walmart in Harlan, and in the Walmart lot in Hazard, and in Pikeville, and several other places in the mountains of Appalachia, Southwest Virginia, and Big Stone Gap, and Appalachia, and Pennington Gap, where you have such small numbers of African Americans, and as is the case in Portland, Oregon, for that matter, that has a very small percentage of African Americans, we saw this outpouring of white youth, primarily, who came out under the influence of their last 25 years, where they have a totally different orientation to Black people than, say, happened in my generation. And so I thought I would write that piece in terms of Black lives in Appalachia, because I was very happy to see that it was white youth who were also saying, "We can't breathe either." And I can imagine that many of their grandfathers and grandmothers who are my age, and I'll be 75 my next birthday, they must have looked at those demonstrations of those white youth saying Black Lives Matters. They probably looked at them, I think, in the same manner that I'd look at people who are Blacks for Trump. And so I was just very happy to see that, to say, thank God there are these white kids who are saying Black Lives Matter to us, too. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I wrote that piece.
Now, you have also had an interesting experience and relationship with the University of Kentucky. You were at the university in the mid-1960s. You were a student activist and leader on campus. In fact, during the course of my own research, I learned that you gave a keynote address there in Memorial Hall on the evening following Dr. King's assassination. And, of course, you returned to join the faculty there in the 1970s as a sociology professor. And then in the early 2000s, you were an administrator as a vice president of diversity. Now, I bring all that up because in the past few months, the University of Kentucky has done several things. They've decided to move the racist 1930s fresco mural of Anne Rice O'Hanlon. The Black faculty have submitted a list of demands to the administration focusing on diversity. The football and basketball teams have taken stands in support of Black Lives Matter. Seeing what's going on today on the University of Kentucky's campus as a former student, faculty member, and administrator, what are your thoughts on what's happening at UK?
My thoughts about what's going on right now at UK are very clear. Clear in the sense of what you might call 20/20 hindsight. That's almost perfect vision. And I'm just almost happy to see what is happening now at my alma mater. I can remember so well, let me put it another way, to see a video on Black Lives Matter put out by the University of Kentucky basketball team, at the end of which Coach Calipari said, "I stand with my guys." To watch that was almost sublime to me, because as you know, when I was 21 years old or 20 and didn't know any better, I was the head of the Black Student Union, and I went and I met with Coach Adolph Rupp and with the AD whose name was Harry Lancaster, Joe Hall, the former coach after Rupp, was sitting in the same room. And I met with Mr. Rupp, who literally looked at me and said, "I don't need any of them, and I ain't never had any of them, and I don't want any of them." He said that to me. I don't care what anybody says. I sat there and listened to him. I later went to Scottsville, Kentucky, along with Joe Hall, the coach. He should remember. I rode with Mr. Hall all the way to a place called Scottsville, Kentucky. I think it was called Scottsboro or something like that. It was the home of a fellow named Jim McDaniels, whom they were trying to recruit when he was a senior in high school. That was 1968. They tried to recruit Jim. I went with them to try to talk Jim into it, sat in his house with he and his parents. That didn't work out. I understand Jim. I know Jim subsequently went to Western, and I remember that like it was just 5 minutes ago. And to now see it all come around in full bloom, even after having been a vice president at the University of Kentucky and having been literally fired because I was trying to get the president at the time I was there, whose name was Lee Todd, and there were things going on that made it look as though I was not on the side of the university, but rather I was on their side. So to look back at all of that and then come forward with the demands recently and how all of that is coming up in a manner to say, I'd be the last to say I told you so, but I am a little bit smug in my own way of saying I may have gotten fired. I may not have been on the right side of that part of it, but I think that I can rest assured that what I was trying to do as a 20-year-old in my own home state meant a lot to me. And the fact that now they're trying to focus on diversity and inclusion in a way that they did not before, and how the football and basketball teams have taken a stance in support of Black Lives Matter, even going back to a period when I was a teacher at the University of Kentucky in the late 1970s, talking to basketball players who would say to me, "Dr. Turner, they asked us not to wear Afro haircuts because that seemed to be a political statement." And to now come 25 or 30 years later to see these young boys who are saying, "We no longer stand for what you used to tell us we could not do." Their political statements to me just seem to be the natural evolution of the way life works. It does not move backwards. It is moving forwards. And those people who continue to think that these young people somehow are going to continue just to sit idly by, it really makes me very happy to see what they're doing.
Well, thank you, Dr. Turner, for your insight and for the inspiration that you have given the current generation. And thank you for the time that you've shared with me on this program. Again, we've been listening to Dr. William H. Turner, who is currently the Distinguished Visiting Scholar in Residence at Kentucky State University. Again, thank you, Dr. Turner.
Thank you so much, Dr. Smith.
We will not bow down to racism.
We will not bow down to
injustice.
We will not bow down to
exploitation. I'm gonna stand. I'm gonna stand.
In this latest installment of our series marking the centennial of ratification of the 19th Amendment, we're visiting with Lexington Fayette Urban County 9th District Council Member Jennifer Masati. she led an effort to add to the visual landscape of downtown Lexington a reminder of Kentucky women who led the fight for their right to vote. Greetings, Councilwoman Massotti.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me on today.
You bet. And when you were last with us here on Eastern Standard, you had just announced the formation of Breaking the Bronze Ceiling, the organization set up to address something that you had discovered about the nature of the vast majority of monuments across this country. Take us back to that discovery and what you had found.
Certainly. It was pretty simple, Tom. I read an article in Time magazine and basically said that public art really lagged behind many issues in the country. You know, women make up about 20% of the United States Congress, 20% of mayors, and I'd say about 24% of statewide elected offices. But when it comes to public art, there's only 9% of some, I believe it's 6,900 recorded works in the Smithsonian American Art Museum catalog of outdoor sculptures that are of women. And I just found that amazing, that such a low percentage of monuments denoted any kind of historical contributions of women. And that just was, again, amazing to me.
So to put it in perspective, what percentage of the American population is female?
Over 51%, for sure.
Mm-hmm. So why, and this might be an obvious question, but why was it important to you to spearhead this project?
Well, you know, like I said, if more than 50% of the population had a piece in making history, we needed to recognize that. Because I really felt like it narrowed the vision for our young girls and young boys and promoted a lack of history regarding women's efforts, their achievements, contributions, and so many sacrifices that they made for society in general. And I just felt that we deserve the respect that men already got portrayed across the country.
The result of these efforts can now be seen on the corner of Vine and Mill in downtown Lexington. The dedication and the lights on came on the evening of August 19th. It was postponed from the night before because of rain. So why is August 18th important?
August 18th marked exactly 100 years since the 19th Amendment was ratified, granting women in America the right to vote.
And you and other Lexington women who joined you raised funds to create this monument. Were these private funds or a mix of private and public?
It was a mix. It was a classic example of how to, orchestrate a successful public-private partnership. No one turned us down. We not only received money from the private industries, but we did receive grants, Knight Foundation, National Association of the Arts, Endowment of the Arts, we received a grant from them. The percentages broke down that we had 81% from individual women, 7% from individual men, and about 12% from businesses. And I'd say the business was provide the bulk of the funding. And of course, the LFUCG gave us a seed money start of $100,000. So that gave us a great running start.
Okay, let's talk about the monument itself. Who created it, and does it have a name?
Yes. Barbara Gragudis is an internationally renowned artist, and she is from Tucson, Arizona. She was one out of a national call of 127 proposals that was limited down to 5 finalists, and her piece was chosen. The name of the monument is entitled Stand, and that is based on her feeling was that women need to stand tall, stand up to be recognized, stand for the brightest, and stand for the vote.
And the monument does not portray particular women. Is there a reason for that?
Absolutely. There were so many Kentucky suffragists that fought and sacrificed so much to obtain the right to vote. It was almost impossible to pick out 5 specific women to be represented by the monument. So the committee felt that the monument should be a composite of all the women who engaged in the fight for the battle of the ballot.
Are there particular women, though, who come to your mind when you look at the monument?
You know, not really. History has so many notable women from Lexington and across the country and across the United States. So we have a lot of them that we profiled on our website, which has got a great amount of information regarding this whole movement and the monument. And that's www.breakingthebronzeceiling.com. And it gives you a little bit more scope of all the women that in our community and how they contributed individually and collectively. But personally, I had a very strong female influence. My mom and my aunts were women of the Depression. And I will tell you, I remember their persistence, their hard work, and their work ethic. And they were, you know, all about bettering themselves and bettering their place in life and bettering that for their family and their children. So personally, I kind of, that reminds me a lot of them.
Well, the importance and the role of public monuments have become a big part of the national conversation over the last few months. Speaking there, of course, of Confederate monuments that are now in question. Why do you think monuments are so important in shaping a community's understanding and representation of itself, of what it is?
Well, you know, monuments make a statement about the ideas and values of individuals. And I think, you know, we need to remember those individuals, if not honor them. I understand it becomes controversial on some of the monuments that have been put up throughout history. But, you know, public art is also there to educate and engage people, too. And there's always more room for public art to honor history and what a community considers really important. So I think it's something that of value, and it basically ensures a better future for all of us.
And what do you hope this new statue says about Lexington and Central Kentucky?
Well, I think the statue brings national attention to Lexington. You know, several communities across the country tried to raise the funds and in order to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, and we succeeded, you know, and we made it on time on the 18th and done. You know, we have a history of leadership with women. You know, we're a pretty progressive community. Over Lexington's 245-year history, there's been a lot of contributions by women. We've had three women serve as mayor. Many women serve on the Urban County Council throughout the years, including myself. So I think, you know, now we have a real engaging and wonderful piece of art honoring female heroes of history that respect and reflect all women who made the nation great.
Lexington Fayette Urban County 9th District Council Member Jennifer Masati, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
That wraps up this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We do like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.